You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I'm Arye Naya. I'm President Emeritus of the Open Society Foundations, and I'm delighted to be here this evening to help launch the book by Priscilla Haina, The Peacemaker's Paradox, Pursuing Justice in the Shadow of Conflict. Looking around at the audience, I recognize many faces, and there are quite a lot of people here who are deeply experienced in the international human rights field, who could just as well be on this side of the table as on that side of the table. So I think we're going to have a very good discussion this evening. The book that we are launching by Priscilla Haina deals with the difficult questions that arise when one tries to bring a conflict to an end, and there can be contradictions between the effort to pursue justice and the effort to end an armed conflict. I don't think there's any simple answer to the questions that arise. I think these are very complex issues, but I think this book does an outstanding job of addressing these issues. Priscilla Haina, it says on the cover of this book, has been active in the field of transitional justice for 25 years. Looking at her, I don't quite believe that that is the case. Since I've known her, I think for most of that period, I give credit to what is stated on the cover of the book. Priscilla was one of the founders of the International Center for Transitional Justice. She is widely known as the leading author on truth commissions, and I think anybody who deals with the subject of truth commissions consults her work and cites her work. For a number of years now, Priscilla has been directly involved in trying to deal with the problems that arise when one tries to end a conflict and at the same time to do justice. Most recently, she has been deeply engaged in the process in the effort to end the longstanding war in Colombia between the Revolutionary Armed Forces, the FARC, and the government military, and also the right-wing militias, which have been an important part of that conflict for an extended period in Colombia. Right now, she is a member of the United Nations standby team of senior mediation advisors. I actually didn't know what that was, and so I asked Priscilla to tell me about it. It's a small group of persons who are called upon by the United Nations to try to help mediate conflicts in all parts of the world, and to bring their expertise in different aspects of the process to bear in trying to end those conflicts. We have asked Richard Dicker to be a participant in the discussion this evening. Richard is somebody I have known even longer than the 25 years Priscilla is said to be active in the transitional justice field. I asked Richard how many people were still left at Human Rights Watch from the day that I was there, which was actually until 25 years ago. And he tells me that there are five people still at Human Rights Watch from that era, another of them, Dinah Kempner, General Counsel of Human Rights Watch, is sitting over there on my right. Richard has long directed the International Justice Program of Human Rights Watch. He was one of those who took part in the effort to create the International Criminal Court. He also led an effort on behalf of Human Rights Watch to bring a genocide prosecution or a genocide case in the International Court of Justice against Iraq under Saddam Hussein for the Anfal, the massacre of the Kurds in 1988 towards the end of the Iran-Iraq war. And the way we're going to proceed is I'm going to ask Priscilla to spend a little time telling us about the book and telling us about some of her main thoughts in connection with the book. And then I will open it for comments and questions by Richard, and I will join in the comments and questions, and then open it up to the others who are here for questions, and again, extremely brief comments. So with that, Priscilla, would you tell us about your book?
Thank you so much, Arye. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here, and especially with you and with Richard. I don't actually usually like speaking from podiums because it seems to be more formal, but I think it's also better for you because you can actually see the person who's speaking. So I'll speak from here, but it's not intended to make it a formal event in that sense. As I said, it is a real pleasure to be here, and also, as Arye said, to be with so many people in the room who have also worked in this field in one form or another. So I hope that you all will come in on the discussion as we grapple with some very difficult issues. So I entered into this book a number of years ago because I was perplexed, and I was also curious, but I was also a bit confused, as well as frustrated. So all of those emotions carried me through to the end. And the reason I was perplexed is because it seemed that it was clear to everyone at the first glance that the tensions between peace, negotiating your way out of a war, and justice, finding accountability for the people who've committed usually very often very serious crimes in a war, clearly there's a tension between them. But I couldn't hear anybody actually saying something that's sort of useful and concrete and in depth enough that we could find our way through. Many people would say, well, we just don't know enough to say something intelligent about this. Or others would say, well, you know, but everyone at the end of the day believes in both peace and justice, so there's not really a tension between them. But I found those unsatisfying and also unhelpful in terms of finding a solution, especially as I was beginning, I had worked in transitional justice for a number of years, perhaps up to 25. And then over the last years, I'd been working more in the field of peace mediation or advising those who are undertaking peace mediation. And clearly this issue was coming up, and clearly nobody really knew how to grapple with it. And it was becoming a bit of a problem. I was also frustrated because it seemed to me that to say, well, we just don't know enough to say something sort of intelligent about this wasn't sufficient for me, because clearly many countries have gone through this problem and grappled with these very issues, and many have actually come out the other side of peace negotiations and had an agreement that in some way or another resolved this tension. So clearly there are things to learn from those experiences. So I started in on this project as, well, let's go ask people what is there to learn and what do we see when you look at the experience out there. So it was very interesting, and I will cite a couple of the key lessons. But the first thing that I learned was, yes, indeed, there is a problem. I think it doesn't help for us to say there's not really a problem here. It's a difficult problem. There's no one solution. But when you speak with folks that are directly involved in conflict, including or perhaps especially the people who are actually fighting a war, they are very aware of this problem in many different contexts. So I was in Colombia. As Arye said, I had a chance to advise sort of on the outskirts of that process over several years, and spoke with the leadership of the FARC rebel group. And they said from day one of those peace talks, we really have no intention to spend one day in jail. At the same time, there were all kinds of obligations that the Colombian state had to hold persons to account who had committed serious crimes. So if the senior leadership of the FARC rebel group is saying that, then you know that that will trickle down and that they don't expect to see criminal accountability, actually prison time, for anybody. And they had, certainly they had the power to just not come to an agreement. When I went to Libya about 6 years ago or so, it was about a year after Muammar Gaddafi had been killed and the revolution took place, and I had a chance to speak with some of the people who were very close to Muammar Gaddafi in his last months and his last days. And it's clear from their description and the conversations that Gaddafi was having with his inner circle that he felt trapped, that the arrest warrant that was out for him from the International Criminal Court, he may have pretended publicly that it wouldn't bother him, but he knew that he didn't have an easy way out, and he didn't know what his options were, or if there were any options, actually. So the only solution he had was to keep fighting, which is what he did. I was in Uganda, where about 10 years ago, peace negotiations ended after 2 years of very serious talks and very close to getting to the point of having Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army agreeing to disarm and actually end that absolutely brutal war. And I was told while I was in Uganda a number of years ago interviewing people about the process, they said, if you had talked to any five-year-old child on the street in Uganda during those 2 years of the talks, and you would say, why isn't there peace in Uganda? And the five-year-old child would say, because of the International Criminal Court, because of the ICC, it's that's why we don't have peace in Uganda. Which, to sort of get to the punchline on Uganda, that isn't entirely true. There were other things that were happening that made those talks very difficult, to say the least, that ultimately they didn't arrive at success and disarm the rebel group. But the ICC influence was considerable. It definitely affected the nature of the talks. It definitely, from the people who were close to, not close to, but often visited Joseph Kony, the very renowned and brutal rebel leader, he was constantly asking about the ICC. What does that mean for me? What does it mean for my people? What actually will happen in the future? So the problem of the peace-justice tension is real. We see that in lots of different places. The solution is not so clear-cut, or it's not so obvious. It's certainly not one solution for every place. What I'd like to do is touch on two issues that might point us either in the direction that I think that we're going or the direction that I think we should be going to help to sort of resolve and cut in to this issue. So the first issue is essentially the question of how one negotiates justice during a peace process. So this doesn't necessarily have to do with an international court coming in. It's something that essentially all peace negotiations now grapple with. And what was interesting to see was in how many cases actually those groups or those individuals that we would think of as perhaps the most obvious and most senior perpetrators of serious abuses, they often were the people that put the issue on the agenda and said, we have to talk about the justice issue, because they wanted to know what their future was. They're not dummies, essentially. I mean, they know, sometimes explicitly, there's actually arrest warrants out for them, or they know that they will be held to account by the government or by an international court, whatever it might be. They want the justice issue to be settled. So it's often there, and it's almost always there, and it's almost always difficult. In a word, because of course we won't have time, unfortunately, at least in this first round, to go into too much detail and to avoid getting into any sort of legalese, which I don't think we won't have time here, and it's not necessarily what we should do here. But essentially, I think there are a couple of approaches to the core dilemma that we have. And you can see a signaling of this in the resolution that the Colombian government and the FARC rebels ultimately came to, which was essentially not giving up on the obligation to prosecute or to hold criminally liable the people on all sides of a conflict that may have committed serious abuses. That is required under international and often national law. But there is more flexibility, interestingly, in terms of the penalty regime, in terms of what kinds of sentences have to be given. So in Colombia, the agreement ultimately is that there will be a regime of restricted freedoms or restricted liberties for those former rebels that have disarmed, and those that have to come through a system of admitting to the truth, telling a new tribunal exactly what they did, and then they actually don't have to go to jail. They have to be sort of confined in a geographical space, basically a village, and undertake reparatory activities, so to pay back through some form of service. A lot of this is still being worked out even now in Colombia, and they're having quite a hard time of actually implementing this. But the idea was captured well, and after a couple of years of really going around as to all kinds of scenarios that might be possible for the Colombian agreement, they ended up with that, essentially playing with the obligations in terms of the penalties. So it's completely legal. The International Criminal Court has said that sounds good to us as long as you fully implement what you've put there on paper. What was interesting, there's a number of surprises that I ran into in the course of my research, as you can imagine. And one surprise is how many stories there are about what actually happens in the course of peace negotiations. Pretty extraordinary stories. But one specific thing I found was that a number of years, it would have been about 8 years before the Colombian agreement, the Ugandans, the agreement that didn't quite get to fruition that ended 10 years ago, they essentially had come to a very similar agreement. It's in the draft agreement that wasn't ultimately finalized and signed in Uganda, but it's not as explicit as it is in Colombia and spelled out in detail. But it's very clear that the intention, and you speak with people who are involved in the process, the intention was Joseph Kony and the others would have agreed to disarm in order to not go to jail, but to essentially go away on a farmhouse somewhere and undertake other activities. So it's very interesting that this is coming up in different places in different time, and I didn't actually realize that history was there. The second general approach I think that would help us to resolve this sort of core dilemma is that for all of us that are interested in advancing human rights, to think beyond criminal prosecutions. So I think the human rights community internationally, I think we've all been a little bit too focused on the prosecution side, which has a number of downsides. One is that you can usually only prosecute a few, even in the best of circumstances, and you rarely have the best of circumstances, so you end up with very few or compromised justice systems or politicized justice or all kinds of problems. But the other major downside is you sort of miss everything else. So if you ask a typical survivor, victim communities that have gone through these wars, you know, what is it that they want at the end of a war? They usually actually, some of them say justice in the criminal justice prosecution sense, but most of them actually focus more on they want the truth, they want rebuilding of their communities, they want reparations, they want to know where their loved ones that were disappeared, where are they? Are there the remains of people who were killed who they don't have? Those, how you get to that, and those elements of a solution are very important. And I should say, maybe as a footnote, to be fair, that in Colombia, in addition to sort of looking at alternative penalties, alternative sentencing, they also incorporated what they considered to be a comprehensive system of justice or transitional justice. So they included requirements to take part in the Truth Commission, requirements to feed information into the search for the disappeared, and various other elements. And they saw that as equally important. The second general issue that I'd then like to turn to is you can hear in some of my earlier stories that some of the concerns have come through from those that feel that justice is threatening them if they're sort of armed groups that feel they might be well prosecuted. Some of that is because of the International Criminal Court, the ICC. So there's two elements here. One is that there's a risk as to what the impact of the ICC might be in peace negotiation contexts. That's the first question I'll briefly address. And the second is a more positive side as to whether the ICC's involvement in these kinds of either peace negotiations or just ongoing conflict, whether in fact it has a deterrent effect, whether it stops crimes or stops violence, in fact. And I think there's a up and the down and the upside of this question. And I'll address them in that order. The question of whether there's a risk to doing damage by the ICC, I think, unfortunately, we can say that there is. And we see this in various places. If you look back at the International Criminal Court's work over the last decade and a half now, it's tricky. But essentially, there are many different specific examples where the timing, the nature, the approach, how public and how private of an arrest warrant is put out, all of these elements add up in terms of what kind of impact the ICC's acts will have on the ground. And you can see that playing out in many different contexts. And when I was working in Colombia, one of the local, very prominent and very impressive human rights advocates who'd been working on human rights accountability for decades, he wrote a blog responding to some of the perceived intervention, essentially, from the ICC prosecutor, where the prosecutor in The Hague was sending signals that seemed to be almost making it impossible to make progress on the justice conversation because she kept saying, you can't do that and you can't do that. And he wrote a blog saying, it cannot be the intention of the international justice system and the ICC in particular to make negotiated peace illegal and impossible. That can't be where we want to go. And he was essentially pushing back, very interestingly, again, from a human rights perspective. Their first priority was stopping the conflict. There were still lots of victims every day. These are atrocious conflicts, many of them. And of course, we know that and we see that in the daily news. We have to, he and others have often argued, we have to take into account the priority of stopping the conflict. And if national actors are finding solutions, we need to allow them room to find these different kinds of solutions without cutting them down at every move. So what I push for in the book is essentially that the ICC prosecutor should perhaps more intentionally and more explicitly take into account the context in which she's working in and the likely impact that her actions will have. This can be assessed in various ways, and I'm not suggesting that the International Criminal Court and the prosecutor doesn't already assess this to some degree. They do, and they're aware that they don't want to be a spoiler of peace. But I think we haven't quite sort of gotten there in terms of really fully taking into account sort of the political side of the equation. What the ICC does will affect the local political situation and armed conflict, and what happens on the ground will affect the possibilities and the possibilities for success of the International Criminal Court. So we need to recognize that. And just in a passing sentence before I get to my final point, there's actually a short phrase in the Rome Statute, which was the treaty that created the ICC 20 years ago. It refers to the importance of the prosecutor assessing whether it's in the interest of justice to prosecute, which is sort of an ironic notion that maybe it wouldn't be in the interest of justice to actually prosecute a serious crimes case. It's not defined as to what that means, but most people, most legal scholars, have pushed pretty far, including people who were there in Rome when the Rome Statute was negotiated, have pushed quite far to say, clearly this was a signal that this was the area where you could have an open door to take into account all kinds of other criteria, context factors. You can interpret the interest of justice in many different ways and very broadly, if that's appropriate. You can get maybe more justice in the medium to long term if you don't have immediate prosecutions now, for example. To make a long story short, the prosecutor still has sort of stayed on a very narrow definition, saying that only pertains to the justice in the specific case. So it sort of has kept closed the door, which could be open, to allowing much more of an analysis taking into account these many factors. I'm going to conclude with my final point, which is the positive side of this question, which is whether and how there's a deterrent effect, deterring crimes or even deterring conflict, actually. And in fact, I have no hesitation concluding after looking at lots of cases and asking about these kinds of examples in many different contexts, I have no hesitation concluding that clearly there is a deterrent effect from the work of the International Criminal Court, that when somebody individually or groups know they are under the spotlight and that the ICC prosecutor is watching, then they change their behavior. They don't undertake violence which was threatened, or they cut back on the crimes which they were thought to be doing. So the deterrent effect, I think, is clearly there. That's positive. The unfortunate second part of that point is that it tends to be a relatively short-term effect. So once they feel like, oh, they're not watching anymore, then actually in the very same place, the very same actions start up again. So there's various examples of that. So that's quite unfortunate. And the other unfortunate thing is that the original hope was that the ICC's existence would have more of a general global deterrence and we would have less human rights crimes all around the world, knowing that this international court existed to prosecute these crimes. But in fact, it tends to be, the deterrence tends to be, at least from what I found, tends to be very specific to that place. So essentially that place and that time. So it does deter. There's been very powerful examples of that, but it's not as generalized as we would all hope, and certainly was hoped when the ICC was founded. I'm going to actually close my comments there. I've gone a couple minutes longer than I intended, but thank you very much, Arye. Look forward to the discussion.
Good. I'm very glad to be here with Priscilla on the occasion of the launch of her book, and of course, with my long ago, but in many ways still current leader, Arye. So, and with all of you, again, thanks. This is such an important conversation, and that's the real reason I'm very glad we're having it, and glad to participate. It's an important conversation because the stakes are very high for the people of greatest concern, that is, communities at risk where armed conflicts are taking place, victims and potential victims. And I think that unifies the perspective of how we're looking at this, though we see the problems and solutions differently than Priscilla has outlined them in some ways. First, there is a problem. And I would say that the reason there is a problem in negotiating peace and justice is because the norms, the prohibitions on torture and genocide and war crimes that came about immediately after the Second World War in the Convention to Prevent and Punish Genocide, in the Geneva Conventions, in the 1984 Convention Against Torture, what's happened is that institutions have been created by the international community to enforce norms that have been on the books since 1948, 1949. And I think that's a darn good thing for the communities most at risk. So is there a problem? Yeah, there is. Is it because of the ICC prosecutor's interpretation of interests of justice? I don't think so. I think it's because whether with the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal, whether with the Special Court for Sierra Leone, and with the ICC, judicial institutions that have a mission to investigate and prosecute have come into being and, if you will, upset the traditional operations where mediators could offer amnesties, explicit or implicit, to individuals who were responsible for horrific crimes. So that's why we have a problem. And I welcome that problem, frankly, because it's a sign of progress. I think justice has made enormous contributions, and just to bullet point them, for example, in, and this is touched on in Priscilla's book, with one Charles Taylor. Now, Charles Taylor, and Priscilla goes into this, the prosecutor at the Special Court for Sierra Leone unsealed the indictment when, at that point, President Taylor was in nearby Ghana for peace talks. The effect, and Priscilla acknowledges this, was to marginalize Charles Taylor and eliminate any potential of playing a role in a transitional government. And I would say, and Priscilla says, that was a darn good thing. We saw the same phenomena earlier with Ratko Mladic and Radovan Karadzic, indicted by the Yugoslav tribunal and thus unable to participate or disrupt the negotiations that led to the armed conflict in the former Yugoslavia. So I think justice's role has played in some, not all, situations, a very important marginalization of bad actors. I think it also helps take guilt from the collective to the individual. It helps make clear these were individuals committing heinous acts. It wasn't everyone belonging to this nationality or ethnicity. So those are two important value-adding functions justice provides. In the long run, and I don't think this is in dispute, certainly justice and criminal trials provide a bulwark against revisionist thinking. And think of that in regard to the Holocaust and what role the Nuremberg proceedings played in staunching, not stopping, but staunching revisionist thinking of scholars of one sort or another. I think justice also helps bring an end to renewed cycles of violence. The downside, to talk about the negative for a moment, is where justice is bypassed, or as I like to say, thrown under the bus in the hope of arriving at a peace settlement. You can see it again and again. Sierra Leone, 1999, the Lomé Peace Accord that gave Fode Sanko, the head of the Revolutionary United Front, whose signature act was amputation of limbs in Sierra Leone. And the Lomé Accord gave Mr. Sanko an important position in government. And shortly thereafter, conflict broke out again in Sierra Leone. Afghanistan, the Bonn conflict of 2002, where Lakhdar Brahimi said, justice, push it to the side, bring all kinds of warlords into the Loya Jirga, the council to create the next government, and let them serve in government. What that did with the likes of General Dostum, who was responsible for suffocating hundreds of suspected Taliban in container trucks, it made him an important official in the government. So sidelining justice, I would posit, doesn't often have the hoped-for benefits that we hear about in practice. And at the end of the day, puts the community that we are most concerned about at renewed, if not greater, risk. Let me say a word about Colombia, and Arye, we know each other well enough, so you'll, you know, hit me or something when I go on too long. Okay. Just a word or two about Colombia. I think that Human Rights Watch has had real concerns about this agreement. It's not that we are against the end of armed conflict that has gone on, as Priscilla has made clear, for 50 years and had hundreds of thousands of victims. It's whether or not the details of the agreement will mean meaningful justice for those responsible, as well as likely to contribute to a durable peace. We've seen problems in that agreement, and we have been fierce in articulating those concerns in service of our underlying theory of change. And that is, when you see problems, you call them out and you put pressure as best you can on the relevant actors to make changes. The concern in the Colombia Agreement, and I want to say right here, we hope it works. I mean, we are not in opposition to a positive implementation. We want to see this work, and we are committed to trying to strengthen the provisions so that it will work. But a real problem is the definition given to responsibility of senior commanders, okay? There is a distinct variance in the Colombia definition of how commanders can be held to account, or what is required to hold commanders to account from the international standard set in the Yugoslav Tribunal and set at the ICC. That is enormously concerning because we fear that those most responsible, given the definition that has been worked out, will be able to avoid criminal accountability. One concern. Second concern, the penalties imposed. It's not that we are addicted to imprisonment. What we have consistently called for has been deprivation of liberty of those who go before the special jurisdiction for peace. And to our eye, the limitations of deprivation of liberty, as Priscilla's comment highlighted, it's very unclear. Does it mean the village? Does it mean a province? What does it mean precisely? We don't know. And we think there needs to be clarity and enforcement in instances of noncompliance with the terms of the deprivation of liberty. Very much related to that is what Priscilla flagged at the outset. That is those in the FARC, the guerrilla movement, are free to campaign and hold political office while serving their reduced sentence in these yet unclear and obscure restrictions on their movement. That strikes us as very concerning, and Priscilla was absolutely correct. The FARC made clear from day one, they see this as a means of them putting down their weapons and entering into political life. But to allow those sentenced to campaign for office and hold political office, to our eye, that undermines the gravity of the crimes that they have confessed to. And let me just underscore, these are not, ordinary burglaries or even ordinary murders, if there are any ordinary murders. They're not ordinary criminal law offenses. These are the most serious crimes under international law, and to allow those who have confessed and been convicted of these crimes then to campaign and hold political office seems to us to really cut the seriousness out of the sanction imposed. I should wind up. I do want to say that deterrence, and I share Priscilla's assessment of deterrence. We've seen it as well as a result of ICC prosecutions, but it is localized and it is short-lived. I've come to the view that it will take years, if not decades, to create the kind of deterrent effect from international prosecutions that we all want in terms of precluding or limiting the commission of these most serious crimes. So I share that and take it a little bit further. And I'm struck today by the commission of truly horrific crimes in a whole number of states that unfortunately, but not surprisingly, are outside the reach of the International Criminal Court. I'm thinking Syria, Iraq, Yemen, South Sudan, and most recently, Myanmar. I mean, I'm not a political scientist, but I do believe it's not coincidental that this rise of crimes has taken place in countries that are beyond the reach of accountability. That's not the only factor, but it's very disturbing to me, and I think the ICC needs to up its game to improve its practice and become a more persuasive beacon for accountability, both in those countries that have joined the ICC treaty and those that are beyond the court's reach, as in Syria, Iraq, et cetera. Let me stop there. And again, thank you, Priscilla.
Thank you very, very much. I will add to this just a little bit. First, on the question of deterrence, the difficulty with deterrence is one is really forced to be anecdotal. You can't really prove the deterrence. And yet, I think that if one has been active in this field for a long period, you do see enough circumstances in which it seems as though deterrence is a factor. I will tell one anecdote, and that is during the war in El Salvador, I recall going at one place, at one point, to a small place in El Salvador where there was a Salvadoran military outpost, but the general area was controlled by the guerrillas fighting the armed forces of El Salvador. It was a place called San Francisco Gotera. I went to see the military commander at the base in San Francisco Gotera. And he had a small office. And on the door to his office, as I came in, he had a full page cut out of one of the newspapers about the trials taking place in Argentina at that point of the generals who had been members of the military juntas that had ruled the country for the 7.5 years of military dictatorship. And it seemed to me he was intent on showing his military associates, who were most of the people who would have entered that office, what the consequences could be of the kinds of crimes that were attributable to the Argentine generals. And I could tell you a great many anecdotes along those lines. So I do think not something that can be proved, but I do think that deterrence is a factor. In my own thinking on this issue, I've had a very difficult time and still have a difficult time coming up with generalizations. My impression has been that each case is sui generis, that you have to look at the particular circumstances, that justice and peace are both crucial, that if you possibly can, but you may not be able to, if you possibly can, you try to achieve both. If you can't achieve both, you try to achieve a measure of each, a measure of justice if you can't get justice. I'll use a couple of extreme examples. In World War II, the Allies took the position that the only way that the war would end was with unconditional surrender. That if the the Nazis had tried to negotiate any exit for themselves, that would not have been a basis for ending the the war. And given the level of atrocities that had been committed, it's hard really to imagine any other approach in those circumstances. In fact, a very large number of people were killed in the waning days of the the war. Probably hundreds of thousands were killed in the last months of the war in 1945, after the war had been won and the Nazis had been defeated, but the demand for unconditional surrender, nevertheless, despite the carnage that took place in 1945, and despite the immense loss of life, seems to me the only possible reaction in those circumstances. Now, an extreme case on the other side, or I think of it as an extreme case, is what took place in South Africa in the transition. And that is that essentially the the nationalist government in South Africa made it clear that they would not agree to a peaceful transition unless there was an amnesty. And an amnesty had to be written into the temporary constitution that would govern South Africa during the period of transition. And Nelson Mandela agreed to the amnesty in the temporary constitution. His justice minister, a man named Dalla Omar, made the best out of the situation. He said, yes, amnesty is required by the temporary constitution, but amnesty has to be individual rather than collective. And therefore, in order to qualify for amnesty, people had to acknowledge the crimes they committed and make full disclosure. And that's what ended up making the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission a particularly effective instrument. But, you know, there were people who challenged that. The family of Steve Biko went to court to challenge the amnesty, and the South African Constitutional Court ruled against their effort to challenge the amnesty. My feeling in that circumstance was that if the transition had not taken place in that fashion, if there had to be armed conflict, at least 1 million people would have been killed South Africa. And it's hard for me to criticize Mandela's decision in that circumstance to go along with the amnesty, even though some terrible crimes had been committed in those circumstances. So these are opposite results in different cases. And I think each case is different, that you have to try to make the best of a situation. That if you are going to try to make peace and the same time insist on justice, you may have to restrict justice to the topmost persons who are ultimately responsible for the most heinous crimes. You may have to say that this will not extend beyond a certain level. And, you know, that can end up putting a great deal of pressure on those topmost persons to go along with a peace settlement, because those who have carried out the crimes certainly are responsible for their own acts. They deserve to be prosecuted and punished, but the persons who are the commanders deserve it even more. Making sure that justice is available for that topmost level may be the best that you can achieve in certain circumstances. But as I say, I have a hard time coming up with a way of determining what approach to use in advance. I think every one of these circumstances has its own characteristics, and that you really have to do the best you can. Peace is immensely important, but justice is not less important. They are comparably significant, and you have to weigh in every circumstance what is the best result that you can possibly achieve. So, Priscilla, do you want to react to those comments?
I'm happy to. I'm also conscious of the time being short. Maybe I'll just say two words and then open the floor so that we have more of a chance for people to come in on the discussion. But, I mean, perhaps just to say, perhaps Arye's comment responded to exactly what I was going to say in terms of Richard's comments, which is that I certainly was not intending to suggest in my original intervention that justice should be sidelined, rather that there should be a strategic approach to justice. And I think on this we all agree. But I think Arye's examples are very much down this line of reasoning. You have to think about that place and that time and what the possibilities are. Now, when I say you, I'm everything from a prosecutor who may have jurisdiction there to local actors to a mediator to international NGOs as well that will affect things locally. And they do and should in many respects, because I think that voice is also very important. But to think about this and approach it strategically and context specific. In a sense, the examples, just responding further to some of Richard's points, although I won't have chance to respond to all of them, but Colombia is certainly a country that has suffered not only over 50 years of armed conflict, as Richard said, but many, many different armed groups. It's not just the FARC. It's many others that were demobilized 25 years ago. And some of those people who were demobilized in the late 80s are now actually central persons in politics. One of them actually is a presidential candidate in the election next month. And there's also one in particular fairly significant armed group, the ELN, which is still armed and still fighting. They're sort of on and off in peace talks with the government now, on and off in terms of a ceasefire holding or not, but there's still armed conflict in Colombia. So FARC was the biggest group but everything isn't over there. And certainly the ELN, getting them demobilized will be probably even more difficult than getting the FARC's agreement for a number of reasons. So to approach the issue of justice in a way that doesn't appreciate the importance of trying to get their armed groups to stop in allowing the national actors to find a solution that will work in that context while fully respecting their legal obligations. I think we, as those that are outside of any country, Colombia and all the others that we're talking about, I think we need to be sober and respectful as to when and how we come in, whether we're NGOs or whether we're the ICC prosecutor, who, of course, she has her mandate to prosecute, but to be cognizant that everything is taking place in very tricky and politicized environments, and that you, as an outsider, is playing very much a role in that. And you could, as I mentioned in some of my earlier accounts, you could feel that resistance, even from, you know, the Colombian human rights community is very strong and very smart and very deep-rooted, and they really felt like they could find a solution, but they needed that space to do so, as well as the political class in Colombia. So perhaps I'll just leave it there. There's all of these issues we could discuss at much more length, but I think it's fair to open up the floor. Thank you very much.
My name is Brenda Tannenbaum. One comment and one question. Reconciliation is not working in South Africa because the white farmers are running to Australia. Their land is being taken again. And sometimes, well, that's the comment. The question is, are these political groups jealous of one another? Are they causing trouble? And is the ICC also experiencing that kind of feeling based on competition between the groups and themselves? And is the ICC political?
Yeah, thank you very much, Priscilla, for the presentation. I wanted to ask you, Carlos Fernandez, NYU scholar in residence at New York University Center for Human Rights and Global Justice. I want to ask you, it seemed to me that there was in your presentation to detect a change of policy in the UN when it comes to amnesties. And I'm referring to the previous policy on not amnesty for crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocides, which was, I think, a side note on the Secretary General in the peace agreement in Sierra Leone. And afterwards, it was in the I think the 2005 principles against impunity. It was also extended to gross violations of human rights. And for your presentation, it seemed to me that UN policy is kind of changing. That's what I understood. So I would like to ask you if that is the case. Thank you.
Okay, so this is actually to follow up on the question of whether, let's say, justice and the enforcement of it by the ICC or in general indeed is a political one. My name is Chester Chen. I happen to be a New York City social studies teacher. And so just looking at a couple of examples in history, for example, should Abe Lincoln be considered a war criminal? What about Moshe Dayan? What about Curtis LeMay? Oh, I haven't seen any cases where these individuals have even been considered for justice. So I think it's slanted in some ways. That's not to say that enforcement or the ICC isn't important. In fact, I am deeply gratified by the investigation of many of the criminals that you all had mentioned. And I really feel even-handed sense of the priority of peacemaking over justice for its own sake. So I deeply appreciate and respect the efforts that have been made. I think it's something that I'm definitely going to get the book, and I can't say enough to support the efforts that have been made. I am, however, once again concerned about the issue of the victors creating the sense of what justice is. Thank you.
George Vickers, ex of the Open Society Foundations. I just wanted to sort of, it's a sort of a combination comment question, but very brief and keeping in, because I always obey Arya's orders. The one is a lot of the discussion around this seems to me framed often in terms, in as though all questions of justice have to be settled in the context of the settlement of a conflict, in conflict situation. And that if they're not, that then there's no possibility of dealing with them. Now, my own sense about a number of experiences, which were not all armed conflicts ending, but also transitions from dictatorship to democracy, in which supposedly avenues of justice were closed off by constitutional methods, as in Chile, or by the realities of power, suggest otherwise. And I think that's important, both because the moment of, you know, trying to settle an armed conflict is the most difficult time, not only because of the people at the negotiating table don't wish to or intend to the extent they can, subject themselves to accountability, but second, the victims and the potential victims have no reason to and are not at all certain whether the terms of an agreement will hold, and that if they come forth and testify and insist on prosecution and accountability, that in fact they rather than being rewarded and feeling fulfilled by that, will in turn get killed because the agreement didn't hold. And I think there's at least there's several places that raise questions about that. Both Chile is one where the creative interpretations of local justices, not just international frameworks. South Korea is another where dictators were in fact ultimately brought to justice because of the continuing insistence upon finding accountability and working around frameworks of impunity that were established at times of transition. So I don't think one needs to give up on the questions of that, although I understand the symbolic importance of it. The second is, I think, from my own experience at least, that one has to be humble about the role of the international community. The international community in settling armed conflicts can advise, can pressure, can provide expertise and suggestions, but the reality is that the will, if you will, of the international community to enforce the constructs it offers or imposes are limited and insufficient without the actual buy-in of local actors. In my experience, the will of the international community to provide support for an agreement that it helped construct and impose is about 5 years. That's how long people are willing to fund it and to provide political pressure for it, and until the next conflict comes along or the next domestic issue that turns attention elsewhere. So the notion that the creation of an international framework of law can actually by itself create the ongoing pressure and power, I'm skeptical based on my experiences of it. So I think it puts me sort of somewhere between, somewhere more with Arya and Priscilla on this side of the question.
Absolutely, thank you so much. And I'll repeat, I wanted to especially address the second question and then the others, and I don't think everyone heard the second question. The mic wasn't quite working then. So the question was whether my comments reflected a change in UN policy in terms of the amnesty. So the UN has had a policy for the last almost 20 years now that the UN personnel and representatives will not support amnesty for international crimes, crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide. That is still stated as a policy. It's not stated as necessarily international law, which is interesting because law is in development. Some people would argue that's actually also law. But to make it simple, this is UN policy. That has not changed, and so I'm very glad you raised that question. And also to clarify that that's also not what I was trying to suggest, and it may have been inferred in my comments, so I completely appreciate that, and I appreciate your question. So what I'm suggesting is actually not, when I say allow room for flexibility, let's say, for example, in Colombia, Colombia actually was never considering amnesty for these crimes. Amongst all the various kinds of ways they were considering approaching it, they knew that that was out of bounds, not only because the ICC was watching, not only because their national law excluded it, which was probably the first point of order, the first port of call if there had been an amnesty, but also there's an inter-American system which also would have cut it down and changed. So they knew that just on the face of it, And Colombia is very legalistic. They are very sort of by the book, and human rights issues and impunity issues are a big issue there. And so they would never have considered an amnesty outright, but they were trying to look at all different kinds of ways to cut in that, which would have been legal, but would have also allowed the FARC to agree. And as we've discussed, they came to that particular arrangement, as we've discussed. But it wouldn't be for an amnesty. And I think in other cases as well, there's various alternative approaches that are being considered that are not amnesty. So just to be very clear about that. So I appreciate that. I mean, just for the record, I'm actually a UN consultant, although full-time, so anything I say doesn't represent the UN in any regard, but at the same time, I fully agree with and think that that policy has been quite important in setting things out from there. So perhaps just two other brief comments. One is that there were two questions that pertain to how political justice is de facto or could be perceived as being, or just the question of whether, in fact, we should see it as political per se. I would restate that as saying, rather than saying justice is political, but to say that the kind of justice that we're looking at is taking place very much in political contexts that you can't escape, right? So you're unfortunately, you, whoever you might be, the international community, local actors, you're constrained by the realities in which you work. It's not that we all wouldn't want to say, well, these principles are X and therefore X will happen. A lot of these things we can't resolve through principles. We actually have to resolve through practical and creative solutions that take into account the principles absolutely, but that doesn't actually resolve the challenges if we just go by principle. So to say that justice is affected by politics and politics is affected by whatever justice initiatives, both of those are true, but that's different than saying, well, justice is therefore just politics. Or, if, for example, the ICC doesn't have jurisdiction in a number of really key states, as Richard correctly stated. And that's unfortunate. You know, things are moving in the right direction, but that's also not going to resolve all our problems either. And perhaps just as a final comment to respond to George Vickers' comment that it's not, and that's right, we shouldn't just think of these issues in the context of what actually takes place at the moment of transition. Not that transition takes place from one day to the next, but at the moment of a war being negotiated and agreed to be ended and disarmament taking place. That's true. And as you said, and I agree, you know, some people will argue that, well, then therefore maybe we shouldn't be too concerned about what the agreement is in terms of amnesty, because then you can sort of change it later. And we can sort of, well, after things change, the amnesty can be changed, and therefore, and I've heard people argue that in the past. I don't think that's the good or smart route, because I think that sort of closes more doors than necessary and creates more difficulties in the long run getting to justice. But at the same time, and this is actually was a surprising and an important conclusion, which I'm, to be honest, still mulling over what it means. But it's rare to find a peace agreement that is implemented as it was agreed, in particular on the justice component. So ironically, one works very, very, very hard, especially those who care deeply about it at the local level, to get the right kind of agreement, and armed groups are fighting to get their protections in place. After they're disarmed, after things start shifting, often actually how things are implemented changes. So we're seeing this in Colombia. It's actually quite a difficult time in Colombia because there's a lot of shifting as to what the agreement will actually be implemented as. And we can see it in many other places. In South Africa, as Arye noted, it was a positive change. There was very little in that final agreement, this interim constitution, but they used that, those few words, to create actually a much more robust system of requiring people to tell the truth before giving them amnesty. So you see all kinds of shifts that people didn't see coming, and especially the people that were most, you know, sort of involved in the conflict, they didn't see coming, because the powers that be also change in terms of who is literally at the table and the discussions going forward, be it members of Congress, civil society, victims. They have a much greater voice as one tries to put things in place. So I think George Victor's comment made made clear that over the time, over the years, things do shift. The trick is to get them to shift in a positive direction. But it's right. We don't actually have it all sealed up at the point of agreement, even when people think they may. Thanks very much.
Briefly, I'll focus on the question about the ICC in particular and politicized justice. And as the departure point, I want to reference Priscilla's comment a moment ago, which I think is spot on, that justice is being carried out on a highly political and politicized landscape, which creates very steep challenges for those tasked to apply justice. I'll tell you what concerns me in regard to the politicized justice. Two themes. First, that the ICC, whether it's in Côte d'Ivoire or Uganda, that it not restrict itself to the side of the insurgents in terms of investigation and prosecution. And I think it's imperative that the ICC prosecutor complete her investigation and either have sealed arrest warrants or public warrants for those who were on the winning side in the Ivorian Civil War, who Human Rights Watch documented were responsible for serious crimes in the west of the country. So that kind of looking at crimes committed by all parties in a conflict is imperative in terms of the legitimacy of any justice institution, the ICC in particular. The second issue that concerns me is what we all know as the fundamental unevenness or double standards that permeate the international justice undertaking. In other words, as best we know, Vladimir Putin is not worried about an arrest warrant or an investigation by the International Criminal Court. Donald Rumsfeld may have been the American. It did restrict his travel plans, but the reality is, and that's a good thing, But up until now, there haven't been investigations that could reach to the most powerful states. And Arye, I remember you saying back in 1997 or 1998 that the ICC needed to be a court that could reach not only those associated with the less powerful states, but reach to those from the most powerful states. I think the ICC is trying to correct a decade of worrying practice from that perspective, in that it has opened an investigation in Georgia that could look at some on the Russian side. I expect the ICC judges will approve the prosecutor's request to open an investigation in Afghanistan that includes looking at U.S. Armed Forces personnel and CIA personnel. And I think that is a very important step. So those are my two criteria of politicized justice by the ICC. And I think we've got to push for them to take on that difficult task. And I'll just wrap up by saying that I think really my point overall is that justice does contribute to a durable peace. There are some tools, and Priscilla refers to them in the book, timing of a prosecutorial decision, and one you've referred to, Priscilla, whether an arrest warrant is made public or kept sealed. And I think those two tools, if used well, can help reduce some of the tension. And finally, we need a lot more than criminal trials. And I couldn't agree more with the point that this is one tool, criminal prosecution, in what must be a very large toolbox to help heal the scars and the wounds that come about from these kinds of conflicts. Trials have gotten so much attention because they are the most controversial aspect, I believe. But let's not lose sight of the picture that it's only one element, and ignore truth-telling, documentation, vetting, reparations, and economic reconstruction, all of which are vital.
Thank you. Priscilla, would you like a final word?
I don't think so.
Okay, all right. I think we could continue. We could continue this discussion for quite a long time, but it's now 7:05, and I think you've gotten some of the flavor. I recommend the book highly, and as I said before, there are copies available outside. So, thank you, Priscilla. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, all of you.